like, I need a stool. It's an honor and pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak. My name is Toby Tedrow, and I am a real alcoholic.
Yes, you are.
Yes, I am. I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I just want to say first, thanks to those guys back there with the coffee and the greeters at the door, especially nice guys. And they really made me feel welcome when I first came in. I'm here to tell my story, and I have about 45 minutes, and I think the young man before me did a fine job of telling my story, too, except for the treatment center's part. Mine actually stayed open for a while. The book tells me I need to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that's the format I usually take. I can tell you that I wasn't born to be an alcoholic or an addict, but that's what I ended up being. I do talk about alcohol and addiction. He was talking about other substances. I will talk some about that, and I will definitely tell it by name because it is a demon drug. I was born up in Montana. My father was in the military. He was a pilot, bomber pilot. My mom was an immigrant from Germany, half Jew, survived the war and World War II. Both of them self-made, and that when he retired, they retired back down here to Tampa after I was born, and I became educators at a small college up north here in Dade City. My mom went on to teach and ended up teaching psychology and became a psychologist for Eckerd Foundation, but during her term getting her psychology degree, you can imagine who the guinea pig was. You know, I'd love to sit here and say, I blame my parents, I blame my mom, I blame my dad, my brother beat the garbage out of me, and that's the reason I'm an alcoholic. But you know what? I can't claim any of that. I can only accept that for myself. What I did and how I got there is all on me. But as a son of educators, you can imagine the emphasis on education was pretty strong, and I had a strong desire to be number one. I kind of identify with Bill W. when he talks about the strive to be the best. Was in him, to win, the desire to win, and that's where I was. But you know what? I never really felt quite comfortable that I was going to be the best, and I saw that in myself. I started shaping decisions in my life based on my ability to be either the top or the bottom. And there were many opportunities that I had that I decided, you know what, I'm just not going to do that. That way I can't fail and I can't win, and I'd rather just be neutral. You know, I went to some of the top private schools here in Tampa. I went to in high school, and I formed bonds with some very close friends. But I found that, you know, I hated arguing. And wouldn't you know, I ended up being a lawyer. I hated argument. My parents used to argue like crazy, and that conflict used to drive me nuts. So I ended up being a mediator in my home, you know, listening to my dad, listening to my mom. Which one? Yeah, I understand. I was put in kind of a precarious position, you know, having to sit and hear one side and then the other and try and stay in the middle. But I found that I was actually a very good place to be. And that sort of sent me out in the world with my friends that, you know, I could fit in by the end of grade school to high school with anybody in the crowd. I could just blend and shape my own behavior to fit in. You know, I could hang out with the jocks. You know, I played a lot of sports, and I could hang out with those guys in the debate team. I could hang out with the heads out in the back alley. You know, I could do it all. And thing is as I continued to adapt and learn how to fit into those situations, I lost a lot of myself. I no longer had a lot of my own opinions, and my opinions were your opinions. What party are you? You're a Republican? Oh, today I am. Yeah, I agree with that. You know, that's a great way to just blend in like that. You don't have any contention and argument, and nobody can judge you. And you can't judge. You can sit there and be a creator of your own destiny. But as I learned to lean onto those friends and understand that, you know, I needed my best friend there. I needed to go somewhere with somebody else. It was symbiotic. I had to have them around in order to have a feeling or emotion or in order to determine whether I liked this or didn't like that. And most of my friends were older, meaning a year or two. And as they started to graduate from high school, I started feeling pieces of me getting torn apart or leaving me, and I was lost, and I was feeling lonely. You know, I'd had a hard time making newer friends. I could fit in. There were a lot of acquaintances, but those close friends, as they graduated and left, I started feeling extremely alone and isolated. And I can remember at the age of 15 or 16, I think I was a sophomore in high school, that first time out at something we called the Cliffs. It was over behind a 7-Eleven on Northdale Mabry at one point, and up there there's a little lake, and they'd go out there and gather on Friday nights, my friends and I, and I'd have beer. And the first time I had that, wow. I remember actually feeling comfortable for a little while. I actually felt like I could say my own opinion, and I was funny. And I could talk to young ladies, and I could, you know, be rather smooth and have fun. And I enjoyed myself. And that was the first time I remember liquor hitting me like that. And as I progressed through high school, I remember trying marijuana and trying other different things. And they never really fit right. I remember getting extremely sick doing that. And, you know, I always said that I had an allergy to pot. Well, you know what? I ended up having an allergy to a lot of different things, as the doctor puts it now. I'm allergic to alcohol. Wasn't that bad at that time. I was a potential alcoholic at that, as I started leaving high school and my friends were gone. And I remember having my first depression and trying to say, where am I going to go to college? And I went up north for a little while. And I was doing well. The drive to success was gone. And I went up away for school for a little while, and I joined a fraternity, and that was the beginning of the end for that period of my life. I started hitting the keg parties, and I found beer and chocolate milk, and boy, I ballooned out to here, and I was sleeping late and missing classes. And my parents yanked me out of there after about a year and stuck me in that college right up here north of here in near Dade City. At that point in time, I had tried cocaine for the first time. When I tried it for the first time after having drank, it allowed me to drink more. I felt invincible. I felt bulletproof. And I felt like I could party all night long. I could study like crazy, and I was just the life of the party. I found a lot of friends who wanted some of that I had, and it was my answer. By the time I got back down here, my parents pulled me down here, I still was doing the habit, and my dad wanted me to get into the ROTC, and I decided to give it a try. And I had just turned down a 3-year scholarship at the college before in the ROTC, but he wanted me to try that. So I was in there, and on this little military trip that we go out on, a young girl was there, and I was looking across, and she started waving her hands and saying, "Warning, warning, Will Robinson," you know, from Lost in Space. And I thought it was kind of cute, and I snickered, and that caught her eye. On that trip, we made acquaintance, and we became good friends. And after a few months, she looked at me and said, you know, as our relationship developed, she looked at me and said, "You know, I don't like it when you do these type of things." "So what type of things?" She says, "The drinking and the drugging. It's not me. I don't like it. It scares me." And at that point in my life, I guess I was about 19 or 20, and I said, "You know what? I have a choice to make. I can either go with her, or I can keep on with the drugs and alcohol and live and party." And at that point, my heart was fixed, and I could, and I made the decision to stay with her. So at the age of 20, I quit cold turkey, drinking, drugging, and I stopped, and I found something that filled that void in my heart. And that's what I really had. Remember, I was feeling lonely. I felt empty, and I kept looking for something out there to fill this hole. And the drugs and the alcohol filled it for a while, and I didn't feel so lonely, and I felt like I could be part of the group, and I could be there, and I was invincible. And then when they started going away, that emptied out again, and I needed something to fill it. Well, while I had the drugs and alcohol, I also had this love interest. I said, "Okay, it's easy. I can just do that." Well, a few years later, 7 years later, after going to law school and remaining dry, we got married. Had a beautiful wedding. Love. Sublime. No drinking. A law practice, 3 kids, house. I had the American dream. I was going great. Until something hit me later in life where I started feeling a little bit, you know, unappreciated. Here I am working all these hours. Here I am, you know, I'm supposed to be the dad. I'm supposed to be mowing the lawn. I'm supposed to be doing this. She's staying home with the kids. And you know what? I deserve more. And I felt like she was pulling away from me. And that I deserve more. I can't be chained down. And I started going with my friends to happy hours. And I started hanging out a little bit later at the office. And I started having some unsavory clients who started saying, hey, you ought to do this, you ought to do that. And I felt that she's going away from me. And that hole was opening up again. As it opened, more alcohol started coming in, and I was reintroduced later to that drug of cocaine. You know, I work with a lot of people. I sponsor quite a few people. And the one thing I've always noticed is that there's no such thing as a stupid addict or alcoholic. We've done some stupid things, but usually there's quite a creative intelligence in all of us. And where it comes from, it seems like, I don't know about you, but when my emotions are untethered, I have an emotional scale. If you think of like a radio, you've got 88 or 85 to 108, whatever the frequency is, and all that on the scale is going like this, you know? With an addict or an alcoholic, it starts at 20 and goes all the way up to 200, and the scale and frequency is like so. And I'm like, nervous disposition when I'm not feeling right. I call it squirrely. And I drink and I do other things to try and feel normal, to try fit within that frequency. And unless I can do that and feel that ease, I'm just not comfortable. So here's my life, my wife, my kids, and everything's being, they're going away, and that hole is opening up, and I'm starting to get like this. And I'm looking for all these things in my life to try and soothe that pain. There was a time in my life, I'm sure there was with all of us at one point, I can say for me that I used to have a lot of fun when I drank. I used to have a lot of fun when I partied. And I noticed the change in me when I started not partying to be happy, but just having to drink and drug to feel normal. To wake up in the morning and say, I need something to get through this day. And my partying started increasing to the point where I was doing something daily. And it got to the point where I could practice well, but I was never coming home. I was giving the excuse that, you know, I need work to work late. I've got so much stuff going on, and I've never come home. But I'd be out somewhere, and I say, oh, I just fell asleep in the office. That hole was opening up even more. And it got worse where I was with some other people, and I was with different places, and I'd wake up in the hood in a suit with stuff all over me looking for my next fix. And that had to do with crack cocaine, because I'd done so much cocaine that I burned a hole in my sinuses and I needed to have something else. And I'd wake up in that pit and look in there, and you know, I didn't belong there. I stuck out like a sore thumb, and I'd see some guy walk in there with like a shirt like mine on and jeans. I'd say, what the heck is he doing here? He doesn't belong here. But yet there I was. One day I woke up where I was in a place, and I was hiding underneath a table in a corner with a friend of mine who was using drinking, drugging, and somebody else, and I was sitting there, and I'm saying, they're stealing my stuff. They're going to hurt me. And I started laughing because I knew I was insane. I knew it. I said, I'm insane. I know it's not true. And I started to wonder whether or not I could ever be sane again. And I remember I've done those crazy things. I've been to the point where I'm down on the floor looking for things and I don't know what they are, trying out feta cheese to see if it really was it, and saying, no, it's awful. And then all of a sudden saying, okay, I better check it again. You know? Just insane. One night I was so bad I couldn't get home, and I had to call my wife and told her, hey, I'm lost. She came and got me, and she says, you got anything on you? I said, yeah. She said, give it to me. I gave it to her, and she took it and chucked it across the room. I said, across a parking lot. I said, wait. She said, what? I said, I might have taken it back and gotten a refund. No kidding. It's true. Absolutely true. And that's my demise. There are many more stories I could tell you, including running down the street naked or in my underwear. You know, till one day in April of 2005, I was out. I had determined to die or determined to get everything away. I didn't want to do it anymore. The police had been to my house or to my office, a lawyer with the police at the office on Davis Island. And I was out one night, and next thing I know, I was arrested on a commitment. My wife had put out a commitment order on me. And it's 3:00 in the morning in the hood, trying to score something else. And I ended up in jail. And that, not because I had a piece on me, I had something on me. And I remember sitting there in jail saying, oh my God, and doing those foxhole prayers, feeling alone, just totally empty. And waking up in the morning for first appearance, and there's a judge who I practiced in front of for 13 years. And he starts to read my name. And he says the first and middle name, and then couldn't even look up. And he said, released to the crisis center. So then I spent 2 days in a crisis center over on Henry Avenue, and boy, I could tell you stories about that place. Here I am, this attorney with a drug problem, and there over there, this guy's walking down the hall while I'm on the phone trying to talk to my wife or someone, I can't remember who it was. And he says, have you seen the cat? I said, what cat? He says, the cat, it was just here on the phone just a second. He goes, oh, that cat. It went down the hall, you know, and, you know, it was something else. There was no cat. At least I didn't see one. And I remember those 2 days and being locked up. Feeling of loneliness, and my brother sent calling me. He said, can you get me out? And he says, you're right where you need to be. And calling my wife and saying, hey, have you tried to get bail? And she said, I talked to him. I said, did you get an attorney? And I said, she says, I talked to him, and he's not going to do anything right now. He says, what do you mean? I said, we'll wait until the first appearance or whatever we can do. And I said, but you want an attorney. I need an attorney. He says, well, what do you mean? Criminal defense will handle it. You'll get out soon. He says, no, I need one for a divorce. Talk about insanity. I'm asking for bail from my wife and then asking for an attorney for a divorce all in the same breath. Totally nuts. Well, when I got out, I started going to recovery, and that was my introduction to AA. And I met my sponsor after a few days, and he was telling my story. It was an AA meeting, but he was talking about the same things I'm talking about, and I could hear him describing me. And I'd been to a few AA meetings, and I hadn't heard people talk the way he did. He looked at it and says, you know, the solution's in here. I can show you a way out. One guy had asked me to write lists. Lists and lists of every lie I've ever made. Call me 15 days in a row to show me that you're willing. You know what? I could barely stay a day sober, let alone 15 days in a phone call. And he says, this is something I can show you a way out. And I sat and I listened to him for a long time, and he looked at me and he said, do you want to get well? I said, well? Nobody's ever asked me that before. I said, yeah, I want to get well. He says, you want to quit drinking and drugging for the rest of your life? And I started to say, I'll do it one day at a time. He says, no, it's a permanent solution. There can be no reservation, whatever. Are you ready to quit drinking and drugging for the rest of your life? I said, yeah, because I've been living in hell, and I didn't want to go back there. He says, well, what I do is I'm going to start taking you through this book, and I'm going to read it to you, and we're going to follow the directions that are clearly and obviously put out in this book in the first 103 pages. I said, I'll do whatever it takes. He says, that's what I want to hear. And we started going through those steps. And in about 30 to 35 days, less than 14 hours, I had gone through step 9, fifth step, the whole deal. I was still a little bit of a daze when I went through, but I've gotten the grosser handicaps out. And by the time 30 days came up, I thought I was cured. And I said, I better go do some amends. And I went to the amends to all those friends I'd had before. And guess where I ended up? I started doing those steps backwards. And I ended up worse off than I'd ever been before. Strung out, lost 40 pounds in 2 weeks. My car was trashed. Never went home. Had a knife to my throat, put to my throat. Been kicked around pretty hard. In and out, just filthy. And this was in the beginning of July. And my arraignment was about 2 days after actually 7 days after I went out. And on that seventh day, I found myself in this little shack of an apartment with a knife to my wrist, two people in the other room, and I said, I can't handle this anymore. And I looked at my hand, I said, I was ready to go, and I was trying to remember, you got to go this way instead of this way. No thought of my wife or my three kids came into mind. All I wanted to do was end the pain. And as I started to go on my wrist, something said in my voice, a voice said to me, you know, that's going to hurt. Looked around and said, why don't you try something else, somewhere else? So I moved it on my palm and started and pull. Ow! And my phone rang. I picked it up, and it was my attorney saying, you got to be here in court. You're supposed to be right here right now. I'm going to have the judge issue a capias for you. He says, no, no, I'll be down there. He says, how long is it going to take? He says, I'll be there in an hour. He says, you'd be here in a half hour. So I didn't understand the relevance of that voice at that point. But I ended up in court in a borrowed pair of pants that were four sizes too small. I ended up with flip-flops, and I stopped at Walgreens on the way there and picked up the most awful polyester Hawaiian shirt and ended up in court. I was there, walked in with a smile on my face. Didn't see anybody around me, just walked in and sat down. I looked up, and there's the prosecutor. The prosecutor and I had taken the bar exam together. The other prosecutor, I'd known her for years. She was one of the judge's assistants and now a prosecutor. My attorney was there, who I'd known since I was 16 years old. And the judge, sitting on the bench, was somebody I'd known and practiced in front of for 13 years. They called my name last, and I walked up there smiling. Good morning, Judge. Nice to see you. And she said, Mr. Tedrow, your wife has filled us in and all these particulars of this. You have a choice. Really? She says, you can either revoke your bond, you can go to jail, or you can go with this guy. And standing next to me was a gentleman who I'd never seen before. And he said his name, and then I remembered I had a voicemail on my phone. He says, Toby, your wife's contacted us. We have a solution. And I remembered that. And it ended up being a treatment center, and I said, I'm going with this guy. And I ended up going, and I remember coming into that place, being totally dazed and confused, coming down off everything that I'd had. And I actually felt relieved. Seemed like the end at that point. I didn't have to worry. Somebody else could take care of me. I remember looking in the back, and there was my wife standing there. I could see it as clear as day. And as I walked out past her, I said, thank you. I think she thought I was being insulting, condescending, sarcastic. I think that's the first honest statement I'd said to her in years. Walked out and went to this treatment center, and I remember being totally relieved, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I living in some sort of strange dream. And I think I finally woke up 7 days later, and my sponsor came out to see me. He said, I don't understand what happened. He says, I do. He says, we got to step nine. I said, yeah, I should be better. Should be doing world of wonder. I said, no. The solution's in step 12. You're still suffering from untreated alcoholism. And that made sense to me. So we started working from where we left off. And he says, remember this, Toby. You never, never, ever are cured. But what you do, what does happen, is you recover. And you can recover from this disease. You're not recovering once you're done. So what do you mean by that? They're always talking about recovering. I said, no, you can recover from this. It says that, first page in the book. We read it. Story of thousands of men and women who have recovered from the alcoholism. I said, oh, it's like bullet wound, he says. I'm sure most of you have heard this. The bullet, you might get shot. You might get hurt, and your body has a natural capability of healing. But you've got to do certain things. You've got to dress it. You've got to take the medication. You've got to do things to help it and assist it. And then after time, you might have a scar. You might have some limited movement. But you can get back into life. I said, okay. He says, but that doesn't make you bulletproof. I said, I understand. I can get back into life, and I can do these things. So we went through these steps and finished it. And most of the people at the center were telling me, you got to wait 2 years in order to sponsor somebody. You only get walking around since till you're 5 years sober. Said if Bill Wilson had waited that long, none of us would be here. Dr. Bob was out, within 2 weeks? Day A number three. Bill started right away. Abby Thatcher brought the message to Bill W., was less than 2 months, and he was out pounding the pavement trying to bring a message of hope to a drunk. My sponsor said, you got to do the same thing. Once you're done, you make a couple of amends. You know what that feels like. And you carry this message because there's no other insurance policy for sobriety. And that's what I did. Don't let anyone tell you not to work with another alcoholic one-on-one. It's imperative. That's what Abby said to Bill. It's imperative that you work with other alcoholics as I have worked with you. Not just going to meetings. Meetings are great. You've got to work one-on-one with another alcoholic. If I hadn't started working right away with other men to help bring a message of hope to them, I surely would not have made it today. I've worked with hundreds, it seems like. Some of them are the closest friends I've got. Some of them, I don't know. My job as a sponsor is to take you through these steps so that you can meet your ultimate sponsor who resides above. But for the grace of God, I go before you today. When I had that relapse, I didn't tell you, when I was in treatment, I made it 60 days and then relapsed in treatment. My counselor said, who needs treatment more than a guy who relapses in treatment? And he was right. And we went back over that, and I said, you know, it was during a time when I had to come totally clean with my wife. There had been some not so good things, as you might imagine. And my counselor looked at me and says, here's what you can do. You have two choices. You can sit there and you can tell her everything's gone on, and the worst thing that can happen is that she takes half your things, she gets the kids, you see them every other weekend, and you pay all the attorney's fees and everything else that goes along with it. Or you can not tell her, and in 3 to 5 months, she's going to find out. And then she's going to divorce you, take half the things you got, she's going to take the kids, and you see them every other weekend, and then you're going to have to pay all the attorney's fees and everything else. So At that moment, I felt like I'd lost everything. And then that's when it hit me. I'd given everything away. There was no choice there. I had made that decision at that point, and I gave it all away. And I had no other choice if I was going to live free in this world but to become honest. And I owed that to her. And I owed it to myself. And I had to realize that I came into this world with nothing. And if I have nothing, I still have the grace of God with me. My faith had turned so strong that I knew that no matter what happened, God would pull me through. So we sat down, had a long discussion, and she looked at me and said, "I'm glad you told me because I already knew it. But you needed to hear it yourself." And she was right. And on that day, after I realized that I had nothing, given it all away, God had given me something back, and that was my family, or at least the hope that I could stay there. That was 6 years ago. They're still with me today. I had some bar issues as an attorney. You know, the court case, I went into pretrial intervention, successfully completed. All charges were dropped, but for the grace of God. Licensing issues, I had a 91-day suspension, but turned into 4 years because I had tax issues. My taxes are almost all paid off. All the time things have been filed. And today, I've been in practice again, reinstated for a year and a half. Practice is going well. I have a bond with my children today that I never thought possible. They are the most beautiful children I ever had, or I ever known. I ever had. That's one of those secrets I didn't want to tell. No. My children are now 17, 14, and 12, two girls and a boy. When I was in treatment, or when I got out of treatment, my car had been keyed back and forth. We thought it was somebody down the street who'd done it. It eventually came out that it was my older daughter. My middle daughter used to tease me when I got home. She said, "Dad, don't you remember the times you used to try and cook spaghetti on the grill?" I said, "What, I took a boiling water?" "No, no, no, you just laid it out there like they're hot dogs, Dad, and trying to cook." I was like, "I don't remember this. Kathy, my wife, did I really try and cook spaghetti on the grill?" She's, "No, she's messing with you again." My son, God bless him, had taken over a role while I was gone as he's 12 now, he must have been 6 or 7, as the man of the family. And when I came home and tried to exert discipline as a father, I got spit in my face. It was very difficult. Those amends are tough to make, and I had to make them. Today I have a wonderful relationship with my son. We talk about all sorts of things, and he actually likes to be around me. My daughters come to me for advice, which I never thought they would. They come for a hug. Just a wonderful relationship with my children. And they are the most important thing in my life. My job is a job. I'm never longer sold myself to the company store. I don't claim to be the best attorney, but I know I'm not the worst. And that's okay. I don't try and kill myself to have the most money or the largest firm or whatever. I'm happy with what I can handle. My wants and my needs have been defined. I know what my needs are, and my wants will be taken care of. It's a beautiful thing to know that that will happen. And that's all because of AA and finding and being connected with my higher power. And you know, I used to think, you know, I said I gave away all this stuff. And the first thing I got back was my family. It took me 5 years to realize that that's not true. Alone in that kitchen with a knife, I heard a voice. And to this day, I believe God has one of the best sense of humors you'll ever find. He really does. You don't believe me? Look at feet. He designed feet, so he's got to have a sense of humor. He sat there, and not that voice that I thought I'd hear, not just like those once, "God, get me out of this situation. I'll never do it again." Well, you end up in jail. I didn't think that was God, but I know today it was. As I sat there in that kitchen, about to terminate and let my life force flow out of my arm, I heard a voice. Struck deep down inside, said, "It's going to hurt." I don't know if that was the actual pull of the knife, or if recovery or life is going to hurt. But I realized not too long ago that the first gift I got back was on that day when I made a decision that I wanted to live. I no longer wanted to sit and feel pain, but I was willing to endure what I needed to do in order to live life in God's world. I was finally able to accept reality with open arms, to be at one with me, with you, and with God. And it's beautiful. I'm willing now to know that I can suffer and know that my suffering doesn't always have to be me. How many times have we sat and suffered and said, "God, why are you doing this to me? Why me?" You know, the point is, I don't need to know. It's maybe not for me, but for somebody else to see that I can get through it and may be able to give them some guidance. And that's what AA is all about, isn't it? One hand reaching out to another, saying, "I've been there, and I can help. I offer you a solution." But for those two guys, or actually Abby Thatcher and Bill Wilson sitting in the kitchen, thousands and thousands and thousands of us, beautiful people, not only outside but inside, would be dead. Families torn apart. Lives shaken. So, you help me more than I help you. Because one of you reached out and grabbed me and said, "Hey, there's an answer. There's a solution, and you can recover." It's a beautiful thing to live life one day at a time, because isn't that what it really is? It's not drinking one day at a time. Maybe at the beginning it was. But today, I live life one day at a time because I don't want to miss any of it. It's a great thing. It's a beautiful thing. And I don't want to miss it. Now, I know I'm a little bit short of time, but I think I want to tell you, thank you all for letting me speak here tonight. Thanks for being here, and God bless you all.
My name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Bob's last message. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 out of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like. So my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, whatever, and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, God, I can't see, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear to those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard the erring members, the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts of on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complicity, so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help, extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.